How are you, Rupert?
I'm very well. How are you this morning?
Very good. I'm very good. So we have a lot of stuff to cover today. Let's talk about universal basic income, if we can. The U-turn, the definite 180 degree U-turn from Adrian Orr out of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, the official cash rate that neither you nor I saw coming, because that's on the record from our
I
conversation
got to eat
last
some
week.
apple pie on that one. That was kind of why I almost didn't want to turn up today, because I've got to admit how wrong I got it last week.
Yeah. Hey, I'm
For
used to
one, I
getting
normally say I
right.
don't know what's going to happen and sit on the fence, and for once I made a call and clearly it was wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think like it's like that with anything, right? When you have a view and you don't share it, there's no point in keeping it to yourself just how much of a genius you are. So the expense or the risk associated with taking credit for things that go well is that you have to wear the stuff that you got wrong, right? But I 100% agree. Was in the same camp thinking that there's no way the Reserve Bank of New Zealand would have reduced interest rates this soon. I was pretty convinced that the US Fed would go first and then New Zealand would follow. However, looking at the overseas experience, I knew that it was possible for other banks to go first because a couple already did. But yeah, so I guess let's start there then. Your general views around the official cash rate now, what do you think? Between now and the end of the year, we have another announcement in October. What's your guess?
I think it's another 50. I think we're going to see a 50 points in October. And this has potentially got something to do with my mortgage coming up for refixing in December. So my hopeful views. But look, I think the truth of the matter is the economy is clearly in a much worse state than the RBNZ or anyone had predicted that it would be in. Because actually, when you look through all the stats don't show, they do show inflation coming down. They kind of, but the tradables are still high, or sorry, the non-tradables are still high. Wage inflation is still high. What we do have, though, is we have seen over the last couple of months, and we're hearing this from anecdotally across so many different areas, is the economy has just gone into a massive roadblock. It feels as though, and I was speaking to some fixed income traders about this a couple of days ago, what they are hearing and what everyone's kind of starting to see is going, look, in about May, bang, all of a sudden things were good. May, everyone's all of a sudden the kind of the bad news is starting to pile up. And I think that is what the Reserve Bank has seen. And that is why they have seen the, that's why they've done that absolute massive U-turn, not because their views on inflation are materially different, but primarily because the economy is in a far worse state than they ever thought it was going to be in at this point in time.
Isn't that weird though? Like how they're always behind the eight ball. In my view, interest rates were kept low for too long. And now, effectively, if this is true, then maybe they kept them too high for too long. However, the whole purpose of the exercise, which they made abundantly clear, was that they were effectively going to get rid of inflation. And if that meant that they were going to drive the economy into the ground, this isn't their words, but that's kind of what they were going to do there. This was a man-made, engineered recession to get rid of inflation, but it was man-made. It was engineered. And so now that it's happening, is that really a way of saying, hey, failure, or is there more to it?
Well, I think that's a great set of questions, right? And I'd love to know what people think on that. I think from a central bank perspective, have they succeeded? Yes, I think. They've got inflation down. That's their goal. That's their job. That's what they're meant to do. Have they caused a whole lot of collateral damage on the way through? Yes. Are they meant to care about that? Who knows? I think they do, but that's the big issue. I mean, I do feel a little bit sorry for them, and that for the last 2 years, 3 years, they have been fighting the inflation battle with their hand, two hands tied behind their back. When you've got governments running 7-8% GDP deficits, that does cause a massive kind of set of spending as well. So, yeah, look, I don't know whether what where they've gone to is can be classed as a success or a failure. I do increasingly suspect out of the US, I think things aren't going to be quite as rosy as we all suspect as well, right? So Yeah, maybe New Zealand isn't going to be such an outlier as kind of having done such a terrible job.
Yeah.
Look, I don't quite know, but I think what we can all agree on is the economy's in a pretty dire state. Mm. That's what last week's announcement was all about. Last couple of days, we've seen some pretty negative immigration statistics and some other stuff kind of, and I think the data keeps on getting worse.
Yeah.
The other point that was raised to me the other day was it took us 18 to 24 months of raising interest rates before that started to bite. So therefore, what do we think is going to happen on the way back down, right? Yeah. Is it a 12, 18 month lag or is it not? And I think that's a big problem that we have with monetary policy, and is we're using historical data, but the tools that we're using to create the different behaviors, they've got such a long lag before they actually take into account as well. So, yeah, I don't know whether we should be celebrating last week or commiserating, right? If you're 35% of New Zealanders that own a house, awesome. It's great news. If you own a house and have a mortgage, that's 35%. Yeah. Great. But actually, all of a sudden, the wage rise probably isn't going to be there, and a whole lot more job uncertainty. So some good and bad in that set of announcements in my mind. It's not all good news like it's been portrayed.
Yeah. And it separates the haves and the have-nots even more. Yep. I think every time there's boom and bust cycles, which are, in my view, further exacerbated by policymakers, not smoothed out,
yep,
that actually increases the inequality problem. Because during these times of high interest rates, there are some people that will lose their jobs before others and will be forced into dumping assets, even their own home, when they really... It's not fair, is what I'm saying, right?
No.
And those that are already well sorted with assets, where their income doesn't come from labor anymore, it doesn't matter. None of this touches them. And so, not that, hey, we should just attack the rich. I'm not going to say that. But
you need to, Thomas Piketty, the compulsory reading for anyone on this, right? The value of labor versus the value of capital. And I mean, who described this the other day? The previous Labor government presided over the greatest wealth transfer ever in New Zealand history. Something that arguably will be the thing that's least talked about, but it's probably the worst part of their record, right? It's the economic policies over the last 5-6 years, or sorry, probably more the central bank policies, have actually just resulted in this massive wealth transfer.
Yeah.
And to be fair, it's what we have seen consistently since the mid-2000s. Right. And yeah, just when and how does that shift, right?
Yeah.
Probably not a bad place to move into UBI.
What's that, sorry?
Probably not a bad segue into UBI as the alternative to kind of constantly everyone getting richer.
Definitely. And like when we're talking about the unemployment data that's getting worse, we're talking about a short-term side effect of central banks crushing the economy to stamp out inflation. But over the long term, yeah, we're potentially going to be seeing technology further make labor kind of redundant in terms of a core ingredient to produce stuff. Robotics and AI can do a lot more probably than we've previously thought. There's still some jobs that can't be replaced, or they won't be replaced yet. But ultimately, UBI, universal basic income, the whole aim of that is to pull people out of poverty, right? Like, yeah, if technology is going to make those who own technology more and more wealthy at the expense of others who now don't have a job, it kind of seems like a problem that we have a responsibility to solve, right? Enter Sam Altman, one of his creations, WorldCoin. Do you know much about WorldCoin?
No, I don't know much about WorldCoin.
It's amazing. So you look into these, so that all over the world, there's these orbs where if you look into the orb and it scans your iris, records your ID, you'll get given tokens, which are effectively a form of currency. So they're financially incentivizing you to register yourself. And the idea, I think, is over time that will morph into some sort of potential distribution system of some form of payment, some sort of universal basic income for those who have subjected themselves to the glare of the orb.
Wow.
You can't make this stuff up. But meanwhile, he's also the engineer behind this study recently, where they want to find out more information around, hey, will UBI, universal basic income, be an effective method to take care of this problem that we have going forward. So I'll let you take it from there, Rupert, in terms of your initial thoughts on UBI. Yeah. Will it work? And what to expect from here?
So this was really interesting, right? I can't remember the number of participants, but they basically gave so UBI, for anyone that doesn't understand universal basic income, as you say, there's a distribution of, mate, let's call it $2,000 a month to every single person in the economy, irrespective of whether they're the richest person in New Zealand, if they're Graham Hart, or whether they live on the street. And it's supposedly enough that kind of goes to get people out of poverty, giving enough people some room to find a home, have a home, have a job, all of those kind of things. And so what the study did, so I think it was in Illinois, kind of off the top of my head.
Yeah.
They did kind of, they control tested this, right? They gave one group $1,000 a month and they gave another group $5 a month and kind of to try and understand and assess behaviors. And they did this for 12 months to determine exactly how they, how people would find this universal basic income and what people would do with this extra money. The study went in with the hypothesis that those that got given incremental money would actually become more productive. They'd kind of use it to educate. They'd do a whole lot of other things. And the general view was that UBI would be a source of productivity. Unfortunately, the study actually showed the opposite. What the study showed was that the people that were given the universal basic income, so the $1,000 a month, they spent less time at work. So they'd kind of, quite a few of them took their hours down. Some of them went back to university to kind of pursue education opportunities. That's got potential to be productivity in the future. And others kind of just said, look, that job's not quite right for me, so I'm going to stop working for a little bit until I find that perfect job. And I think, to me, it was fascinating, right? Because it depends a little bit on you as a person. But to me, what it really demonstrated, most people don't work because they enjoy it. Most people work because they have to. Most people work because that is what pays the bills. And if they can't pay the bills, they're going to get booted out of their home and they can't afford to pay their kids. And the moment that you gave someone another way of paying their bills, of feeding their kids, not getting booted out of their homes, they grabbed at it with two hands. And actually, rather than using it as a way to better their financial situation, and kind of use it as a way to get ahead, actually what they did is they went, cool, that just means I need to work less because I know how to survive on my $2,000 a week. So now $1,000 coming from over here, which was, I thought, awesome and really interesting, right? Because I'm a big believer that people need to, they work to live. You don't live to work. And if anything, this study showed me that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like I've in the last 24 hours, so I've read a, I guess you'd call that an article on this topic. And it was probably along the lines of what you're saying. And so what I did was I went out and I read a couple of other things that was for UBI. And then a couple of things that were against it, just so I can get a little bit of balance and tons of stuff out there. It's a massive area, right? Like a couple of things just to throw out there. You have government superannuation. That's kind of a form of UBI for old people, right?
Yeah.
And we've had that for a while. You have the unemployment benefit where there is some sort of social safety net and it's there if you need it, right? But when it's universal, it means it applies to everybody no matter what you're doing. And I think it taps into the fundamental nature of humanity, which is when given the choice, we'll always select the thing that gives us immediate gratification over long-term gratification. We're much more likely to act impulsively out of our emotions rather than actually think about this long-term. Some people would take $2,000 a month and they would go, fantastic, I'm going to apply that off. Pay that off my mortgage really quickly so that I can do other things. Other people would just go, yeah, I'm going to scale down my work, enjoy myself. I'm going to go study basket making and make tea cozies for the rest of my life. And, you know, that's my contribution to society, right? So I don't know if it will actually increase productivity. And in fact, my gut feel is that anything which involves a redistribution of wealth in any way, especially through government, will result in poorer outcomes. Because you're taking away from productive areas and then you're putting that resource into unproductive areas. There's no way. But the really interesting thing that came up was just how important it is to consider the relative impact of this financial benefit. So if you were given $2,000 a month right now, your life would probably in the short term improve. You'd feel happier. You'd have more time. You'd be able to have some freedom and you'd feel excited for a while. But if it wasn't increasing at a pace which was allowing you to open up more and more opportunities or consume more and more over time, which is kind of how we're programmed, unhappiness would probably result shortly afterwards. There is something about this need to work, not necessarily for the financial, but need to work for a sense of stretching and striving, reaching for more, which I think maybe men more so than women, if I dare say, would have that hardwired. So you take away that or you disincentivize that, you just create a whole other social problem right there. But full circle, how do we solve the problem that a lot of our jobs are going to disappear?
But I don't think they will.
You don't think so?
I mean, I think Excel in accounting is a great example of one, right? You go 15 years or kind of automation. Automation is not new. Automation has been with us since or for all time, and particularly since the 1970s and 1980s, right? You look at where we are today, you go accountants in Excel, kind of, and now we've even moved beyond Excel into Xero. You look at automation in a robotics automation in a car factory, where a car factory can now run on 50 or 100 people, whereas previously it was 10,000. Yet we are still in a world where we've got all-time lows of unemployment and we're desperately kind of searching the world for more labor. So I think the jobs that are some of the jobs that we currently do, those jobs might not be kind of so important and they might not be there, but there will always be new jobs. And I think that's what we kind of need to get ourselves our heads around and get ourselves comfortable with. AI will be able to do a whole lot of tasks and a whole lot of things that we currently can do. But at the end of the day, what that means is as human beings, our value add needs to get more and more and more. And that's the challenge, right? As a person, how do you continue to add value? And the bar keeps on growing. But over the last 60 or probably over the last kind of 5,000 years, we've consistently proven as civilization that we are able to keep on improving, right? Mm. And that's what we have to keep doing. And to me, AI is no different to that.
Mm. I think it's just probably for me anyway, I'm just trying to think of this from the perspective of the rate of change. So if the rate of change or the rate of displacement of traditional jobs with technology, if that was a linear curve, I wouldn't have any problem with what you just said, but because it's an exponential curve, that's where I just wonder if there is a risk that going forward, there could be a larger group that might be displaced relatively quickly, or at the very least, this technology or the impact of this technology isn't going to be evenly distributed. Probably speaks again to the inequality that happens every time there's market intervention.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if there will be a time where the rate at which AI and robotics can displace jobs becomes so fast that, you know, we've solved the unemployment issue or we solved the lack of labor, but now it's really starting to bite. Don't you think that would be a risk going forward?
I'm probably slightly more skeptical for the simple reason that internet, right? You go that period from 1997 probably through to 2003, I mean, the revolution that the internet caused in the workplace, I mean, that actually created a whole lot of jobs, right? And I think I don't debate for a second. So again, the internet the jobs will not be the same jobs. There's no question on that, but there will be a whole new world and it will take longer than we think. A perfect example of this is an article I was reading this morning. It was talking about how hedge funds trying to figure out how to use AI to do the job of the most junior analysts. There was this one hedge fund, that Man Group, one of the largest hedge funds in Europe, and they've now got a full-time team of 15 people working on AI models and AI tools to enable the rest of the business to work. It might end up doing the job of a couple of analysts. But actually, I suspect what's going to happen in that world is it will do the job of maybe they'll have 15 AI developers over on one side, but actually it's rather than it being less jobs in that example, I suspect it will mean that the portfolio managers get better decisions and better information. And again, coming back to the analogy of the internet and Excel and those kind of tools, they've made us so much more efficient around how we operate and what we do. That hasn't taken away jobs. It just means we're better at decision making. And that's where I see a lot of the AI and a lot of those things going. Mm-hmm. Where, yeah, so I'm not at all worried about it.
Yeah.
Because I just think history has shown us time and time again, every time we have one of these revolutions, it actually creates far more jobs than it removes.
Yeah, I totally agree. I guess for those that are willing to treat it as what it is, which is a tool, right? Yeah. But interesting, like when you zoom out, you see that every time new technology gets released into the wild, it actually helps people to mine wealth, yep, which was previously locked down in old ways of doing things. And your example there inside the hedge funds, you could apply that in any business which involves a degree of research, like legal would be massive. Even my own business would be huge. The way that I could improve, the way that I provide human advice is enhanced because I don't have to waste time at the information layer. I can move up way better on the advice layer, and that even goes higher yet again to perception. And you can do that when you're using the technology. Not everybody's going to do that though. That's the problem, right?
Oh, exactly. And that'll make the difference between a good advisor and a bad advisor. But that's just the world we live in, right? Mm-hmm. You have to evolve. You have to keep on improving. And as we all know, the day that you stop improving is the day that you die.
Yeah, that's right. And on that morbid tone, let's talk about the market meltdown.
What, about a market that refuses to die?
Exactly, yes. And how, hey, maybe good news is bad news, bad news, good news. And it's like, it never ends, right? Until one day, maybe it does. But at the moment, markets are fickle. We haven't had much new news to really move the market one way or another, apart from the Japanese yen carry trade surprise, kind of like, hey, that was there the whole time. But from here until, say, the end of the year, apart from the normal pre-election jitters and uncertainty that potential civil war in the U.S. could bring about.
Or war in the Middle East.
Yeah, or just war everywhere, really. What have we got to deal with here with markets? Is it really as simple as saying that as the cost of money potentially gets cheaper, there's more money that's incentivized to play in equities? Is it really that simple? Or is there a little bit more to it?
No, there is a bit more to it, but kind of, yes. I mean, more money is available for equities. Plus, at the same time, equities should do better because you've got a whole lot of debt sitting inside companies that all of a sudden that becomes cheaper and consumers do a whole lot better off, right? So there's a big part to it. I think coming back to what we said earlier about New Zealand, though, right, there's a strong assumption that lower interest rates will immediately provide the turbo boost to the economy. The big challenge from an acknowledged skeptic like myself is, hey, higher interest rates never really hurt the economy that badly in the US until they kind of are now, but we're talking 2 years later. What does that mean that we'll be able to do a quick turnaround on the way down as well? So markets at the moment, it's 100% an interest rate story. That's all they care about. We're back into a soft landing territory. But we do also need to be mindful. Volumes are very low. So we're still in midsummer break. All of our traders are still at the Hamptons. They've kind of come off the Olympics. They're now down on the French Riviera. There's not actually a huge amount happening, right? So August is always a quiet month. And I think it's not until we get through to September that we're going to start to see more of this kind of come through, right? All of the data does pretty clearly show that the US is slowing. At the moment, the market likes that because that means lower interest rates. Market's now basically 100% confident that next month we will get an interest rate cut. So, yeah, we're kind of just waiting to see from here where it goes. Anything, but the market is on edge. Like, let's be really clear. If we don't get that interest rate cut, that's going to be bad news. If we get economic data coming in significantly worse than expected, that's going to be bad news. Yeah. There's a whole markets are definitely looking for an excuse to sell right here, and we saw that a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. I fear that we're kind of we are in that position yet again. The big issue is that you can't bet against that because based on kind of what we've seen over the last 2 years, we could easily put another 5 or 10% on before we get to that sell down moment.
And we have to think about it in terms of volatility rather than being confident that it means it's going to go down if this happens or up if that happens. All we really know is that volatility will probably increase between now and, say, January, and plan accordingly, or I guess not plan accordingly, but be confident in how your portfolio is structured, because that should outlast situations like this anyway. You don't need to really worry about it. But it's fascinating, though, that this year the sell in May then go away sort of thinking kind of true, right? And we often forget this, but in New Zealand, it gets colder from May onwards. In the Northern Hemisphere, where that phrase sell in May, go away comes from, specifically Europe, that it's the summer months. It's when people do go away. They're less engaged in markets. So when they kind of come back to work and get their feet under their desk and get established again, that's when it seems like proper dynamics generally happen. But this time, we can't really say definitively, can we, that interest rates will set the market on fire, because it's the second and third order consequences as to why those lower interest rates exist and whether that's so negative that it causes the market to sell off because it's factoring in bad news from somewhere else, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, man. Interesting, eh?
It's going to be a fascinating 6 to 12 months, it's 3 months. I would bet we will see some more episodes like we saw a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
But at the moment, there's nothing too strong about it to see where it runs, right?
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. Hey, that's all we have time for today. Next week, I want to dig a little bit more into, you know, what is going to happen in markets between now and the end of the election cycle specifically. So perhaps we can do a bit more research around the policies from the different political leaders in the U.S. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, that's a great topic. I'd love to talk about that. Yeah.